You're going to be on the respiratory tract this week. So who's sick?
Elisa.
All of these hands go up.
She's low on the respiratory.
Stay away. Okay. Where's my finger here? Okay, anatomy of the upper respiratory tract. We can divide the respiratory tract into upper and lower. So next week we're going to do lower. So this is just upper, and it includes the sinuses, wherever they are, the nasal cavity, the oral cavity, the mouth, back of the throat area, the nasal pharynx, down here, the throat part, the epiglottis, we're going to talk about later. Okay, and notice here the eustachian tube, this little tiny, tiny tube that connects the upper respiratory tract to the ear. So it's very easy to get ear infections from the flora that exists here, particularly in infants. So we'll talk about that later. Tonsils are up in the ear. Okay, so all that is the upper respiratory. So that's what we're talking about this week. In box 32.1 in your textbook, there's a list of organisms. Notice all of the organisms. There's a whole bunch of them in the oral cavity. These are pretty much normal flora. Strep, anemolytic strep, non-group A, strep pyogenes. All of these are anaerobes. What would be a coag negative staph?
Epidermidis,
most likely, in the throat, right? Okay, so these are occasionally present, so we're going to talk about these today. We might even have a fungus, candida, and virus carrying herpes simplex, so there's a variety of things. Okay, so these are the pathogens. Now, normally when we get a sample from the throat, it's a throat swab. And usually, depending upon the age of the patient or whatever the situation is, the doc is oftentimes only interested in whether or not the patient has group A strep, strep pyogenes, strep throat. So oftentimes the instructions, I'm trying to think of the right word, from the doc on the requisition form or on the computer or whatever, says just rule out beta strep. When it says rule out beta strep, that means all they want to know is there beta strep or not? They don't care about anything else. That's all you have to check for. Okay, so that's the main one, is group A, beta hemolytic strep, strep pyogenes. You know all about strep pyogenes from last week, all the characteristics, what it is, okay. New ones that we're going to talk about this week. We're going to talk about the Neisseria genera, Bordetella, Corynebacterium diphtheriae, but notice this is toxin-producing Corynebacterium diphtheriae, and we're going to talk about Haemophilus, Waxella. So these are the ones, particularly the Neisseria and Haemophilus, are the ones that we're going to be doing in lab this week, new ones. They can be present in the throat, they can cause upper respiratory tract infections, but they can do other things too. So those are the ones. The others that I haven't underlined here, we'll talk about later, so don't worry about those now.
Just out of curiosity, the Bordetella pertussis, is that the same one that you can get from dogs? Dogs get vaccinated against that, isn't it?
That's okay. Different. I think that's different.
Is it?
Because this is whooping cough. This is whooping cough. And I don't know that it causes anything in dogs. Okay, so the specimen we want for upper respiratory is a throat swab. Throat swab is very good for isolating strep pyogenes, for isolating Corynebacterium diphtheriae, and for isolating Haemophilus species. We can also use a nasopharyngeal swab, which is better if we want to isolate Neisseria species or Bordetella pertussis. But oftentimes we don't get a nasopharyngeal. We just get a throat swab. So we can still isolate these from throat swab. It's just better if we have a nasopharyngeal. Now, what's the difference between these two? Can you all have a throat swab?
Yes.
Anybody not have throat swab? Oh, Yuki. Okay.
You never had a throat swab?
Right. Well, we're going to
have throat
swab. Okay, so for a throat swab, you just use the tongue blade, depress the tongue, stick the swab into the back of the throat area, behind the uvula, that little thing that hangs down. making sure you don't touch the tongue or the cheeks because of all the normal flora in there. So you just want to go straight to the back and touch on each side of the throat. It's a non-invasive technique.
Oh, sure.
Which means you shouldn't draw blood while you're doing this.
You can draw puke.
You might do that, yeah. And then pull it straight out again without touching anything to avoid contamination from the normal flora. Okay, and that's what we usually get most, and it does cause people to gag a bit.
Unless at the health center where they do mouth swabs.
Well, how do they do a mouth swab?
Oh, well, they attempt to do that. My husband went in for his strep test, and I was like, so they swab your throat? Well, they swab my mouth.
Yeah. Right, which you don't want to do, because you might not get the strep pyogenes there. If there are any white patches, of course, we're probably not the ones that are going to be doing the swabbing, but sometimes, depending upon where you work, you might be. But you still, at times, have to convey the instructions to whoever does collect the sample. So you need to make sure they understand how to collect it. If there are white patches that you happen to see at the back of the throat, you want to make sure that you touch those. Okay, the nasopharyngeal is done with a little tiny wire and a bent swab, and it's very much smaller than the throat swab. And that goes through the nasal passages to the back of the nose area, the nasopharyngeal area. And that's primarily where the Neisseria and the Bordetella hang out. So you can get swabbed that way, but that's a little more difficult to do. And so that's why we usually just end up with a throat swab. Okay, what media are we going to use for the throat swab? Okay, most labs will use just a blood auger and a chocolate auger. Tell me what's unique about chocolate.
X and B.
Everyone talk at once.
It has X and B factors. And what are the X and B factors needed for? Which organism? Haemophilus. Okay. What is MTM?
Modified Tater Marker.
Okay. What's that used for? Alex. Let me down. Anybody? MTM, what do we use that for? Bill?
Neisseria.
Neisseria, okay. So it is selective for Neisseria, particularly pathogenic Neisseria. However, there is one species of Neisseria that is not pathogenic that will grow on it, and we'll talk about that when we get into Neisseria. It is selective for Neisseria because it has all of these antibiotics in there, which inhibit gram positives and gram negatives and some fungi here and swarming of Proteus. Now, what about doing a gram stain on a throat swab? Is that helpful or not? Usually it's not helpful because of all the normal flora in there. You're going to have a lot of strep, a lot of staph, a lot of non-pathogenic Neisseria. I shouldn't say a lot, but some. A lot of non-pathogenic Haemophilus. And you can't tell the difference between the pathogenic species and the non-pathogenic species just from a gram stain. So usually a gram stain is not helpful from a throat swab. We are going to do it today. Just to give you practice of doing a gram stain from a swab, but in normal cases, they probably wouldn't do it. Okay, and again, most labs will use just SBA and chocolate. We're going to include an MTM here because we are dealing with Neisseria this week. And I want to give you another exposure to MTM and a little better chance to isolate the Neisseria. But you don't have to use that. You can still isolate Neisseria on chocolate. The chocolate is primarily for Neisseria and Haemophilus. Okay, let's discuss the Neisseriaceae. This is the family. It's got four genera in it. The Neisseria, Moraxella, subspecies Bronomella, Acinetobacter, and Kingella. Okay, the two that we're going to talk about, two genera, are Neisseria and the Moraxella, subspecies Bronomella. We're not going to talk about the others. Later, we'll come back and pick up Acinetobacter. These are in the non-fermented group. Okay, so in general, Neisseria are gram-negative diplococci. They have flattened adjacent sides that we describe as coffee bean shape. So here's the Neisseria. You see the diplococci where they are together, they have these flattened adjacent sides. So we will have some Neisseria as knowns this week, so make sure when you look at the gram stain that you look specifically for the coffee bean shape, diplococci. And they're pretty good size, gram-negative. They are fastidious. What does that mean? Okay, they need usually a little more special growth requirements than, say, a strep or a staph. So we use enriched media. That's the chocolate. And usually, these are one of the temperature-sensitive organisms that grow best at room temperature, or not grow best, but are maintained at room temperature. We don't want to refrigerate them. So if we take media that's directly out of the refrigerator, it's cold, and it might inhibit the growth somewhat of the Neisseria. So what we do in the lab oftentimes is take the chocolate auger or the blood auger, put it in your hands and warm it up, or let it sit out at room temperature for a while. Some people even stick it under their arm and warm it up. So whatever you want to do, but that helps to isolate the Neisseria if the media is warmed, and it does require CO2. Okay. Sometimes these organisms can be phagocytized by, what is this cell right here?
Phage.
P-min, phagocyte, it's a neutrophil, low nucleus. And these are the gram-negative intracellular diplococci. You can see them phagocytized inside the white blood cell. If you see that, that's pretty good diagnostic evidence that you've got Neisseria. But you don't always see that. We used to call these gonids. Do you call them gonids, Bill?
I don't know.
What does gonid stand for?
Gram-negative
intracellular diplococci. Gonids, yeah.
So what is the source here where we're getting this slide from?
This looks like a blood sample. Because we've got a lot of red blood cells in there. Okay, Neisseria meningitidis, specifically now into the species. Meningitidis can be found in the nasopharynx and the throat. Some people are carriers, so up to 15% of people can have a small amount of Neisseria meningitidis in their throat as carriers. Usually it causes meningitis, so we're going to come back and talk about the disease state later when we get into the central nervous system, spinal fluid analysis. So we're not going to talk about the disease state now, but it can be found in the throat. So just isolating Neisseria meningitidis does not necessarily mean it is the pathogen. It depends on the clinical symptoms, the age of the patient, and also what you look at when you culture these organisms. If there's just a little tiny bit, just a small amount of growth on the plate, it's probably not the pathogen. But if there's a larger amount of growth, then it's more likely the pathogen. So you look, that's one way we kind of semi-quantitate. You look for the amount of growth on there when you're trying to decide is this, and you can't find any other pathogen. Okay, we're going to introduce a new test, the oxidase test. Okay, the way we do oxidase is that you should all have an empty Petri dish. Do you all have those that were handed out last week? Were they handed out last week?
They were not handed out.
Okay, this week, each of you get an empty Petri dish and a piece of filter paper that fits inside the Petri dish. Keep that in your drawers. When the filter paper gets used up, throw that away and just get a new filter paper, but keep the Petri dish. Okay, so the way we do an oxidase, and you can look in the book to read the principle, is we take, it's a little dropper bottle, and you have to crush it first, and then you take one drop onto the filter paper, take a wooden applicator stick. This is the best way to do it. There can be other ways to do it, but take a wooden applicator stick, touch the center of your colony that you suspect is Neisseria, and then put that wooden applicator stick on the drop of oxidase on the filter paper. Scrub it around a little bit. Just kind of rough it up, spread it around so that we break open the Neisseria, releasing the enzymes that are going to react with the oxidase. what we should get is a purplish color. I mean, this is a pretty positive. Oftentimes, sometimes it might be just a little tiny bit of purple. We're looking for the development of purple color within 30 seconds. So you have to ignore anything or disregard anything after 30 seconds. So just the development of the purple color within 30 seconds. Now, another reason that we do knowns is so that we can compare the reaction of our knowns with our suspected unknown. Because these can be variable. The classical Neisseria meningitidis will be oxidase positive and catalase positive. You're going to have catalase. One drop of hydrogen peroxide on the slide. Okay, so the classical ones will be positive, but we have found over the years that our Neisseria can be variable. So if you happen to get a negative oxidase or negative catalase or whatever, don't be too concerned about it. Just see what other people are getting to make sure that you're not the only one that got a negative And if yours, if known, happens to be oxalate negative, then if you think you have suspected Neisseria meningitidis for your unknown, and it is also oxidase negative, that's a helpful clue. Compare that with the known. Okay, remember how to do the CTA sugars. We did one. We did the CTA lactose. Anna remembers. Yep. How?
Those were the boobs.
There were two. Your memory didn't fail you. Yes, they were tubes. Okay. We just did a CTA I think we did a glucose. Did we do CTA? Oh, did we do lactose? Okay. So from now on, when we do CTA sugars, we're going to do a battery. So we do all three of them. Glucose, which is probably labeled dextrose on the tubes. Glucose, maltose, lactose. So do all three of them. And the reactions that we get in those three tubes will help us differentiate four organisms. Okay, the way we do it is we use our loop, get a heavy inoculum of our suspected Neisseria, stab 3 to 4 times just in the upper inch or so of the tube, tighten the cap. Okay, this is the exception to the rule of loose cap. So you put a tight cap on it and stick it in the incubator. 37 air, no CO2. And if it's a good reaction, you can see the reaction, the positive reaction, within 24 hours. But you may have to hold it up to 72 hours.
Do they ever do an overlay?
No, you don't do an overlay on these. Just tight caps. So if it's negative, hold it another day and just see what happens. Okay, and it's best if you take your inoculum from non-selected media. In other words, if you can isolate it from chocolate, it's best to use the inoculum from chocolate rather than the colonies from MTM, because MTM is more inhibitory, since it's got all those antibodies in there. Which order are we going to streak these plates? Three plates that we're going to streak.
Blood,
chocolate, MTM. Okay, you go from least inhibitory to most inhibitory. So that's the way we're going to streak our plates. So if you can't get good isolation or you can't tell on chocolate which organism is the Neisseria, then you can use the inoculum from MTM, but make sure it is a heavy inoculum to overcome some of the inhibitory antibiotics that might be in there. Okay, what we're looking for as a positive reaction is fermentation of the sugar, glucose, giving us a yellow color in the upper inch or so. And the negatives will stay red. So we have to record all three of these results. Now if it's yellow all the way throughout the whole tube, then it's probably a contaminant. It's probably not Neisseria. I shouldn't say contaminant. You probably put the wrong organism in there. And it's not Neisseria, because Neisseria will not change the whole tube. But one way you can check for purity is just to do gram stain of the organism right at the very top of the tube. Just take a little bit, do gram stain, and see if it's pure Neisseria or if it's something else.
Did you say that we stab only the top or all the way
about through? About an inch. Inch under the surface. Uh-huh. Half inch somewhere there. Just stab it 3 or 4 times. Not all the way down, just the top. Okay, so you don't have to do CTA sugars yet. All right. So Neisseria meningitidis, classical reaction is glucose positive, maltose positive, lactose negative. And this one, they are fastidious. Neisseria don't usually grow on blood. This one will grow a little bit on blood, but primarily we're going to look for growth on chocolate and MTM. But it grows very well on chocolate, and that's why hospital labs don't have to include an MTM, because we can isolate it very well from chocolate. But we're going to do that just to give you a better chance. Okay, the other species, Neisseria gonorrhea, is always a pathogen. So meningitidis may not always be a pathogen, as we mentioned. Some may be carriers, but gonorrhea is always a pathogen, and sometimes you can find it in the throat. More specifically, it's a sexually transmitted disease, so we're going to talk about this later when we get into the STDs. But since we're talking about Neisseria this week, we need to describe its characteristics. So again, it should be oxidase catalase positive. However, it can be variable. CTA sugars, glucose positive, maltose negative, lactose negative.
Okay, variable, is that on the oxidase
and the catalase? Yeah. So let's see what we get. I don't know that we've got gonorrhea as a known this week. I don't think we do. But we do have other Neisserias. Okay, and this one is more fastidious than meningitidis, so it does not grow on blood. But it will grow on chocolate, and it grows on MPM, because it's a pathogenic Neisseria. Gram stains look identical for all the gram-negative diplococci and copy bean shape. Okay, third Neisseria species. Yes?
Question with the gonorrhea. How does the CTA look? Does it, will it still, if it's positive, the upper inch?
Just the upper part.
Okay.
Yeah. In fact, the one we looked at, this is gonorrhea.
Okay, so
because it's just the glucose that's positive. Okay, Lactamica. Lactamica is normal flora. So this is a Neisseria that we find in the throat that is normal flora. And that's why the gram stains didn't really help you that much to differentiate Lactamica from meningitidis, for example, because they all look the same. Oxidase catalase positive, classically, but again, could be variable. CTA sugars, all three are positive, glucose positive, lactose positive. Now, what's an easy way to remember these reactions? If you set them up in this order, this is what I always do. I set up glucose, maltose, lactose in that order. Okay, if glucose only is positive, what is it? G for gonorrhea. If glucose and maltose are positive, M for meningitis. If glucose, maltose, and lactose are positive, L for lactamica.
Meningitis. Is it normal flora?
Meningitis can be normal flora. There are some people that are carriers and carry a small amount, but if you isolate it and it's in larger amounts, then it could be a pathogen. But again, it depends on the age of the patient and the clinical symptoms. You see it mostly, Neisseria meningitidis, you see it mostly in children up to 6 months to 2 years of age, and again in adolescents. So we'll talk about that more when we get into central nervous system. Okay, Lactamica can grow on blood, so it's not as fastidious as the others, so it will grow on blood, it will grow on chocolate, and even though it is not a pathogen, it will grow on MTM. So if you see growth on MTM, what's the first thing you're going to think?
Neisseria.
Okay, but not necessarily a pathogen. It could be Lactamica, but usually anything else should not grow on MTM. Okay, Rhodomela cataralis. This used to be Neisseria cataralis, but these organisms change names frequently. As they do more and more studies, they find out that it's not really a Neisseria, but it's more closely related to the genus Rhodomela. So they put it as Rhodomela cataralis. And now, the newest change is that it is in the genus Moraxella. So we call it Moraxella subspecies Rhodomela cataralis. So sometimes you see it as Moraxella cataralis, sometimes you'll see it as Rhodomela cataralis. Okay, this is usually normal flora in the oral cavity. But, and we used to just disregard it as normal flora once we figured out it was just Rhodomela. But it can be an opportunistic pathogen. So that means in some cases it can cause these disorders, acute bronchitis, maxillary sinusitis, meningitis, even pneumonia. So it's possible that it can be a pathogen. So we can't just disregard it anymore. We have to speciate it. Oxidase catalase positive, CTA sugars. Okay, these are all negative. So if they're all negative, it's Rhodomela or Moraxella. It will grow on blood and chocolate, but it does not grow on blood. It's gram-negative diplococci, so it looks like the others in terms of its gram state. Okay, we're going to change direction here. Everybody awake? All right, that was comfortable. Okay, let's go on to the Haemophilus organisms. These are gram-negative rods. They are tiny. Here's the gram stain. They are pleomorphic, which means sometimes they can look like cocci, and we use the description coccal bacillus, but that is not a true shape or form of an organism. organism. It's just the description. These are rods. They're gram-negative rods. But they're much tinier. Sometimes it's hard to differentiate these from the Neisseria. But when you do your gnomes, because we've got known Haemophilus and known Neisseria, make sure you look closely at the known gram stains to differentiate them. These are much tinier. They're not diplococci. They're not coffee bean shaped. Okay? They grow usually only on chocolate in CO2. So you said that chocolate has the X factor and the B, lutein and NAD, so they require that. At least some species do. Not all of them require both factors. They are temperature sensitive. So, again, like Neisseria, we keep these at room temperature and preferably use warm media to facilitate better growth from the organism. Okay, let's do Haemophilus influenzae. Okay, this one is more pleomorphic than the others. And sometimes you see these long filaments in the gram stain. If you see those filaments, and it's probably just several organisms linked together, if you see that, that's most indicative of Haemophilus influenzae because the other species do not do this threaded or filamentous form. But notice some of them look tiny cocci, some look longer rods. So look around, look at several fields and get the most predominant picture, most predominant impression. Okay, now Haemophilus influenzae is kind of problematic with trying to determine if it is a pathogen or not. It's normal flora. It can be normal flora, but it can be a pathogen. It's usually normal flora, but it becomes less frequent with increasing age. It can cause sinusitis, particularly in adults, sinus infection. Pathogen, especially infants and children, and there's a certain serotype. There are different serotypes of these organisms. This one is type B. But now, children get a vaccination, the HIB vaccine, Haemophilus influenzae type B, usually around 2 months. Did Michael get his? Mm-hmm. Okay, good. So if they get that vaccination, then this used to be the number one cause of meningitis in children, of young infants. But it's not anymore because of the vaccine. However, there are other serotypes that are not type B that can still cause meningitis. So it can cause meningitis, acute endocarditis. We'll talk about that disease on Wednesday again. We'll save meningitis until we get into spinal fluid. Okay, I put here catalase positive, oxidase positive with a V. What does V mean?
Variable.
Okay, this tends to be more variable than Neisseria. So sometimes I wonder what's the use of doing these tests because they can turn out to be anything. But we're going to do them. They're very simple to do, very fun, very fast. So we'll still do catalase oxidase. Remember to compare your known with your suspected unknown. Okay, after we've decided that it is Haemophilus, then we need to speciate between influenzae and peri-influenzae. Those are the only two species that we're going to be concerned with. Okay, Haemophilus influenzae requires X and V factors. So, the way we do this test, we used to take 1 mL tube with 1 mL of sterile water in there and make a suspension. But we're not going to do that. Okay, so cross that off. What we're going to do is just take our organism directly instead of making a suspension because we have trouble oftentimes getting a positive reaction. It's very difficult to see. You don't get really good distinct colonies. You just kind of get a shadow of growth. So what we're going to try to do is instead of making a suspension of this in water, we're just going to take a heavy inoculum of our organism from our plate, chocolate. Are we going to find this on MTM? No. And streak it on a half a plate of tryptocase soy agar, TSA agar, tryptocase soy agar. You can use it on a half a plate, then you can put your known on the other half or whatever you want to do. You put these discs on, these are just discs, say X and V, and you put them on the sterile forceps, just like we've done the other discs. Put them approximately a quarter inch apart. If you get them too far apart, it's not going to work. If you get them too close, the organism is not going to be able to grow. So what happens is the X and V factors from the disc diffuse into the media. And where both factors exist, that's where the organism is going to grow. So it would generally grow between both those discs. But again, if you get them too far apart, then they can't diffuse together. So approximately a quarter inch apart. And then just incubate them overnight. Sometimes it might take an extra day to read these, but we're just going to kind of look for shadowy growth, not really good distinct colonies. Okay, so that's Anopheles influenzae. Now, it does not grow on sheep blood auger. Why doesn't it grow on blood auger?
Because it can't.
No, it doesn't have the X and the B factors. It doesn't have both those factors in there. But it will grow. There's a test that's called satellitism. If there are colonies of staph, particularly beta hemolytic staph or strep that causes beta hemolysis, lysing the red blood cells and releasing those factors into the media, then you can see these little tiny Haemophilus colonies growing around those. Sometimes they'll streak the plate for isolation, and then they'll just take a loop of known staph aureus and just put a loop down through, across the whole plate. And that helps to look for satellitism. But we'll look for it because we're going to have some mixed cultures and there might be some beta hemolytic colonies in there. So that's satellitism. That's usually the only way it grows on blood auger. Now, some of our organisms have been around for a while and they've gotten a little lab smart, I guess. But sometimes we do see a little tiny bit of growth on blood auger without beta hemolysis. So when I just... Never and always are probably not good words to use because there's always exceptions. All right, the porphyrin test. Some labs will do the porphyrin test. We're not going to do the porphyrin test, and I'll let you read about it in the book. But the porphyrin test can be read in 4 hours, so it's a quicker way to identify or speciate these organisms than is the X and B factor test. The substrate, if the organism does not require X factor, it will convert the substrate into porphyrins, which are fluorescent. So we just take a Wood's lamp, a fluorescent lamp, and shine it, and it fluoresce. That's a positive test. We're not going to do that, and I don't know how many labs do that. But just read about the porphyrin test. This one is negative because it is not X independent, does not have the X factor. Okay, Haemophilus parainfluenzae. This one is usually normal flora, but it looks just like Haemophilus influenzae, with the exception of the filaments if we happen to see those. We have negative, tiny rods. Catalase negative, oxidase negative. I didn't put the variable on here, but these can be variable as well. This one requires B factor only, does not require X factor, and is porphyrin positive. So this is what it should look like if it is parainfluenza with the X and B discs. Okay, here's our X and B discs. We'll see growth in between, but primarily we're going to see growth around the B. And it's not going to be just in between. It's influenza, it'll just be in between. It won't be going out here. Okay, so that's parainfluenza. Now, sometimes students will take a colony that they think is Haemophilus, but it isn't really Haemophilus. So if you do that and you see growth on the whole plate, or the half of the plate that you've inoculated of the TSA, you know that it is not Haemophilus, because Haemophilus is not going to grow way down here, away from these factors. So if you see growth on the whole plate, it's not Haemophilus, and you've picked up the wrong colony or done something wrong. You can always gram stain this to make sure that it's pure as well. So gram stain, you can always do gram stains. Okay, other Haemophilus species. There's Haemophilus hemolyticus, which is usually not found in the human respiratory tract. It's rarely encountered in the human respiratory tract. But this one, as its name implies, is hemolytic, so it will grow a blood auger. So in rare instances, it's possible that we could see that. Not usually. Okay, Haemophilus aegyptius causes an eye infection, conjunctivitis. We'll talk about that when we get into eye infections. And Haemophilus duprii causes a sexually transmitted disease known as chancroid. We'll talk about that when we get into the STDs. So this week we're just dealing with influenza and parainfluenza. Okay, let me go through the lab procedure before I go on to other organisms. Just make sure we've got time so you know what you're doing when you go to the lab today. Okay, known organisms, we've got four of them. Do these in pairs again. So we've got two Haemophilus, parainfluenza and influenza. We've got Neisseria meningitidis and Moraxella catarrhalis. So what I want you to do is one pair, or one person in the pair, do one Haemophilus, so a parainfluenza and a Neisseria. And the other one do influenza and Moraxella. So that way you get experience doing an Haemophilus and a Neisseria or Neisseria type. Okay? You can divide that up any way you want. Okay, we're going to streak them on blood chocolate, MTM, and then we're going to do Graham's thing. These are all our knowns. And these are on plates, because they don't usually grow in broth real well, so these are on plates. So just take them off the plate and streak them for isolation, and then do the Graham's stain. Okay, and then for our unknown, it's a throat swab. Streak blood, chocolate, MTM, and do a Graham's stain. Okay, now the way you do this with a swab, okay, is you take the swab, and again, we'll inoculate them in this order, blood, chocolate, MTM, least inhibitory to most inhibitory. Take the swab and inoculate the primary quadrant on each plate. So do SBA first and rotate the swab so you get all sides of the swab. Do heavy inoculum back and forth on the primary quadrant on the blood. Then go to the chocolate, do the same thing. Go to the MTM, do the same thing, primary quadrant. And then take a glass slide and roll the swab on the slide. You don't have to put it in water, just roll it on the slide. And try to get as much inoculum as you can on the slide. Sometimes it's hard to do a Graham stain from a swab. Then let it dry and go ahead and do the Graham stain. Okay, what we're going to start doing now is we've got more than one organism, and we may have normal flora, and we may have pathogens. So I want you to indicate, after you've identified which organisms are, identify which, or indicate which is the most probable pathogen. And that way, it'll start helping you to learn more what is normal flora and what is pathogen for the throat swab. Okay? Because that's what you're going to have to do when we get to the final practical. At the very end, this will all come back to haunt you. So learn it now. Speak.
If you've got two bacteria that could be pathogens, so you just do it by like which is the most, has the most growth.
Yeah, that would be one way. We don't know the age of the patient. We don't know symptoms or anything else. So just put the most probable. If they could both be pathogens, then indicate they could both. But I just want you to start thinking in terms of normal flora versus pathogen.
So are
we
still streaking the whole plate or just the primary?
Oh, no, I didn't finish. Okay. Thank you. I had forgotten to finish. Okay, after you've streaked the primary quadrant and all these with your swab, and then done your Graham stain, we have to do the Graham stain last. Why?
Isolation.
Because it would contaminate. The slides are not sterile. You don't want to do the slide first. That would contaminate your swab. So you have to do the media first, and then do the slide.
So this is all one swab, right?
You don't same swab, one swab.
Okay.
No. You get one swab, and it will be in a transport media. Amy's or Stuart's media. Okay, so what you do, then after you've done your primary quadrant, you go back with your loop, and then just streak for isolation. So you go over your primary quadrant with your loop, go back and forth several times so that you get it spread out good, and then just turn your plate and streak, do all your other three quadrants, streak for isolation. And what are we going to do on the SBA? Stab, stab, stab. Okay. All right, let's look at the flow diagram that we're going to use. Okay, remember, this is just, well, right here is just a very brief flow diagram for the Gram-positive CAFSA. So if you have Gram-positive CAFSA, remember, those are still fair game, because we can find those in the throat. Go back to the flow diagram that we used last week, because that's bigger for identifying the Gram-positive CAFSA. Okay? So over here, chocolate plate and MTM. So now you're going to have three plates, and you're going to have to do Graham stains tomorrow from your growth. You're going to have to do Graham stains from the blood, from the chocolate, and the MTM. So you're going to have to start doing a lot of Graham stains. And you're going to have to correlate, okay, which means which colony, describe your colony growth, which colony on chocolate is the same as which colony on MTM, if you have growth on MTM. Or which colony on blood is the same as which colony on chocolate. So correlate. So that's why you have to do these Graham stains on all of the plates, not just the blood, but all of them. Okay? So if we have gram-negative diplococci, what are we thinking?
Neisseria.
Okay, we're going to do an oxidase catalase, and we're going to set up our CTA sugars. Remember the battery, glucose maltose, and I added lactose because this didn't have it on here. And remember our little way to remember. Okay. And that's all we have to do for Neisseria. Okay. Ronamel is over here, which is all negative. Sugar is all negative. Okay, if it's gram-negative coccobacilli, which are really rods, tiny rods, we may see satellitism, we may not, then we set up the X and V test. If it requires both X and V, well, first of all, we're going to do oxidase and catalase. I don't move that up here. So just like over here. So we'll do the gram stain first, and then we'll do oxidase catalase, and then we'll set up the X and V. If it requires both, it's influenza. If it's V only, it's peri-influenza. If it goes over the whole plate, or if half the plate that you streak is not Haemophilus influenzae, you've got to go back and start over again. Okay, so that's the flow diagram that we're using. Okay, let me go on to Corynebacterium diphtheriae. This is not one of the organisms that we're dealing with this week. Because this could be a potent pathogen, so we're not dealing with this one, but you do need to know about it. Gram-positive rod. Remember first, when we talked about skins, we talked about a Corynebacterium? Pseudodiphtheriticum. Yeah, Corynebacterium pseudodiphtheriticum. And it was a gram-positive rod, so it looks the same. Let's see. Okay, that's what they look like, gram-positive rods. And we often refer to these as Chinese letters because some of them look like they just kind of snapped as they break apart, snapping like right here. And so they're often described as Chinese letters. So these look like the normal flora, the Corynebacterium pseudodiphtheriticum that might be there. Okay, we'll grow on blood augur. Some strains are hemolytic, not all. So we usually streak a blood auger, and then we use a special medium for Corynebacterium, which is Leffler's serum medium. It's an egg-based medium. We need to grow the organism on Leffler's so that we can then do a stain called a methylene blue stain, which enhances metachromatic granule formation. Let me explain that a little bit more. Okay. Okay. Now, you probably can't see this up here, but you have a sheet that you can look at a little bit more closely. So, for us, now we're not going to automatically suspect Corynebacterium diphtheriae unless the physician, the doc, tells us that there's some suspicion that the patient has diphtheria. Usually people here get inoculated or vaccinated, so we're not going to have as much chance of developing diphtheria unless they traveled other countries or people have come here or something. So the doc usually needs to inform the lab that there is an index of suspicion before we really start looking for these. But it will grow in blood. So growth on blood, and then we do the methylene blue stain from Leffler's medium. So here's Leffler's medium, the egg-based medium. So we probably will inoculate both the blood and the Leffler's. Once we get growth on the Leffler's, then we just do a methylene blue stain. You don't have to memorize all of this stuff. You don't need to know how to do it. We're not going to do it. But we do that so that we can identify metachromatic granules, which are these little polyphosphate granules that exist in the organism, and they stain very darkly with methylene blue. That's characteristic of Corynebacterium pseudodiphtheriticum. Now, notice I put this slide in upside down. On purpose. Just to show you that it looks the same, upside down. Okay, there's another media if you're isolating from a mixed culture and all you're looking for is Corynebacterium diphtheriae. Then we can use a very special medium called Tellurite, or on the previous chart, this is Tinsdale, but Tellurite is probably used more. And Corynebacterium will grow as these dark brown, black colonies, whereas other organisms won't grow. So usually we use that medium just to isolate only Corynebacterium diphtheriae. Now, the other thing we have to do is, there are, remember when I talked about pathogens, the slide that said pathogens, I listed Corynebacterium diphtheriae. What did I say about it? There was something special about that.
Toxin producing.
Corynebacterium diphtheriae. So there are some strains that might be normal flora in the throat that don't produce the toxin. if they don't produce the toxin, they are not pathogenic. They probably got the genes to produce the toxin from a virus. Transduction, is that the proper term? Viral affected bacteria. So we have to do a test for the toxigenicity to see if it is a toxin-producing organism. And that's called the Ehlig plate. Okay, this is the way we do an Ehlig plate. And many times a normal hospital laboratory won't do this. They'll send it to a reference lab to do this because they don't have the requirements and everything to do it. You take special media, this is Ehlig plate that's got some rabbit serum in it and telluride reagent in there. And we take a piece of filter paper. This is filter paper. And dip it in diphtheria antitoxin. You dip it in diphtheria antitoxin, and then you apply it to the surface of the plate before the plate has completely hardened. And then after that's hardened and dried, it's ready to use. Then we use the quality control strain, positive and negative, and we take our unknown, and we streak perpendicular to the filter paper with the antitoxin on both sides. And then, after it's incubated, we look for these little precipitin lines, usually at a 45-degree angle. So sometimes you have to use a hand lens or something. They're very faint. So that's an indication that it is a toxin-producing strain. Okay, Bordetella pertussis. We'll have to finish this on Wednesday, but let me just start. Gram-negative rods, toxoid. So they're a bit larger than Haemophilus, but they're still gram-negative rods. Some of them exhibit bipolar staining, which means they stain a little bit darker on one end or the other. And this is the cause of invasion of whooping cough pertussis, which again we don't see a whole lot of because of the vaccinations. So if the doc suspects whooping cough, needs to let the lab know. Because we probably don't have the media or Bordet-Jungeau media available. So we'll stop there and pick that up on Wednesday.